Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Hi, I'm Karen Pugliese, Editor-in-Chief of Candleland, filling in for Jesse Brown. I want to tell you about a story that I saw in the Eganville Leader. It was last December, and it had a picture of this young girl. It was Nevaeh Sarazan. Now, I don't know her, but I like to keep up on what's happening back in my home community, Pequawknagon. Nevaeh is 15 years old, and in her photo, she's wearing this gray hoodie, her long brown hair is parted down the middle, and she just has the biggest grin on her face, ear to ear, for real. Now, Nevaeh was the junior female head dancer at last year's powwow, and she's been dancing since she could walk. Her mother, Gina Sarazan, used to drum for her. But that's not what got her picture in the paper. She just won $50,000 for her community. Now, that's one happy kid. What does a high school kid do with $50,000? Well, she's giving some to support the powwow and some to community services like sweat lodges, and she even wants to buy a Zamboni for the community's outdoor rink. I asked Greg Sarazan, her older cousin, about it.
Definitely a whole lot easier to take care of your ice with a Zamboni than it is with a fire hose. We're very proud of her. She's a role model for the youth, most definitely, and she sets a fine example for everybody.
Now, that's the way I know my community, tight-knit and proud of its culture. But there was something else going on at Pequawknagon. It's there in paragraph 10 of Nevaeh's story, when she says there isn't as much money as there used to be for youth programs. And in her words, the kids today get involved with drugs and everything. That article about Nevaeh was published in December. Now, Greg Sarazan, her cousin, he's also the chief of Pequawknagon. Around the same time as that article came out, Chief Sarazan declared a state of emergency. I'm going to talk to him about what's happening.
We're about an hour and a half due west of Ottawa. As you say, Highway 17, two around Cobden and Cobden, you would turn left and come through Eganville into Golden Lake.
If you've never heard of these towns, that's okay. There's no reason you should have. As you leave Ottawa and you drive west towards Algonquin Park, the towns just keep getting smaller. You pass a lot of cows and farms in between, and it takes about an hour and a half, according to the chief.
You turn off Highway 60 and you cross the Bonnechere River and come on to the First Nation. And when you're on the First Nation, the first spot that you will encounter is the Kokomish Gaspar and Restaurant. Then if you turn left at the restaurant and go another 2.5 kilometers in that direction, you're at the end of the reserve, so it's not very large.
Chief Sarazan was born and raised here. He's the first of seven children. He has seven children and seven grandchildren.
We try to get together every year and stay close and make sure that the grandchildren know each other and they grow up together. My grandfather was a traditional birch bark canoe builder, as was my father, and my dad passed away in 2006, and his canoe shop endures beside the Bonnechere River, right beside his father's lifelong home, and the shop is still there, those tools are still there. My mom is 82 years of age, she's still alive, and she helps me out once in a while and make sure she puts her hand to it. My brother Henry is also a birch bark canoe builder, and my son helps out from time to time as well, and I'm hoping that he'll take up the family tradition.
When it's running, the canoe shop employs up to 12 people. There's jobs at the band office, there's a gas station and a museum. Those tax-free smoke shops, and once it became legal, pot shops that popped up on reserves all over, they're here too. It's a small community, but hundreds of customers come in every day.
We're not isolated from surrounding communities. We're very much part of the economy of our area. We have a thriving economy in Pequawkmega, and that brings outside, you know, money and resources into the community.
The graduation rate is high, employment is at 80%, and that's high for a rural community or a First Nation. The books are tight. It seemed to me that the community was doing well for itself. But just as business comes in from the outside, so too do troubles. Last year, the surrounding county saw a spike in overdoses and drug-related deaths. Tanya Kuchki knows a lot about the opioid crisis. Like me, Tanya lives away. She's a few hours away in Orillia, but she has strong connections to Pequawkmegon.
My grandfather, growing up, he was a chief for some time. My grandmother, she started dancing and she would make regalias. And I can remember still she had this little candy store and she had a sewing room in the back. And she made my first regalia, which I still have. And we danced.
She wanted to be a singer or a dancer, but instead, she became a cop. Off-reserve cop, that is. Pequawkmegon doesn't have a police force. But today she's not wearing her uniform. She's talking to me only as a concerned community member. One thing she knows is that tranquilizers are being added to the drug supply here, same as in the cities. Xylazine is one kind, but all of them are dangerous. They put users in a deep state of unconsciousness, slowing their heart rate and breathing and increasing the risk of overdose. Naloxone, the drug used to stop opioid overdoses, won't work on the tranquilizers.
Tranquilizers, like, they're being added to other drugs, and anyone who does have, an addiction, they're not necessarily in the know that that's what they're getting when they get it. Of course, anyone who is selling, they're adding to the product so that their product is something that buyers will want. And unfortunately, there's several reasons. I mean, obviously, they use it as a cutting agent, but also extending the high. It's a different type of high, I understand. I don't know what that feels like, but I understand it's a different type of high. And I think that once they've tried it, they want to try it again. So I think what they're doing is adding it into other drugs that people are using as well. And unfortunately, you don't know when you're going to get a batch that actually has those added into it.
We don't know how many overdoses there have been in Pequawkmegon exactly. The chief says not everyone dies and not every overdose is reported, but what we do know is there was at least 5 overdoses last year in a community with only 250 adults. That's 1 in 50 people overdosing. Even more must be using. We just don't know how many. But it's not just about those on reserve. There have been dozens of overdoses when you count the cousins, the kids, and the other family members living away.
Everybody is connected in one way or another. We have about around 550 residents on the reserve, although our total population is around 3,000. Everybody is connected in one way or another, either by family or social connections. We're a very tight community for the people who live on the reserve, but a lot of our relatives live off reserve as well.
He means people like Tanya, or like me. Full disclosure, my cousin Don is on band council. He was the first one I reached out to when I heard. And he also means Kevin Lamar. Actually, Kevin just moved to the reserve after a 5-year wait. Like most First Nations communities, there's a long waiting list for a home here. He's a health services worker working with the Ottawa Valley Ontario Health Team. He's also a drummer and a singer who weaves cultural teachings into his work. According to Kevin, there's a history of addiction here. He was once alcohol addicted himself. And that doesn't surprise me. Pequawkmegon, like other First Nations, has been through the ringer. Residential schools, the child welfare system, the fallout of those programs that caused so much trauma is here. And the community's been working on it. But over the last 5 years, it's gotten really bad. People who were not users became users, and casual users became addicts. Crime increased, and death became more possible. What's new is the fentanyl.
So there's always been issues with addiction within Pickwackinac. Now the substance has changed. It's causing more fatal impacts than what was previously used, right? I lost a friend. There's like suspected use that contributed to his death recently.
I asked Kevin if he wants to talk about his friend. He doesn't. It's still raw.
Like, I just lost him this year. I don't really want to talk about him too much. But there's been other members too. We've lost other people that I grew up alongside with. I just don't want to give all kinds of names. And I can say there's about 3 or 4 people that I know have passed to the suspected overdose. And last year, what I heard from just like talking to people on reserve, there was someone who had to be revived 3 times in one night with naloxone.
The chief says concern peaked last November.
Myself and the council members are having this discussion ourselves, and people are having this discussion as well. And then they're talking to us, and we're hearing it in the public forum of Facebook and the groups that are on Facebook. And now when you ask what was the turning point and where did we get to, well, the answer is there's no definitive answer. You can't just say that was it there. And that's what I was trying to get to earlier. This is something that's been building over a period of time. And as the overdoses mount, and as the deaths mount in our entire population, both on reserve and off, then people will become increasingly frustrated. It's like, oh no, not another one. Another one. Oh my God, something's got to, you know. And frustration hits a boiling point. And then my brother's death back in November.
The chief's 58-year-old brother, Joseph Sarazin, was killed in his home. His death added to a growing sense of fear in the community.
My younger brother, Joe, born and raised in Pickwackinac, moved to the city as a young adult, worked in the federal public service until he retired about 8 years ago now, and he moved to Pickwackinac, and he lived here from that time on. He was well-known and well-loved by his close friends. He was quick to help anybody out. If they needed help, and whether they knew they needed help or not, he was there to help them. And he was always happy, and he was always quick to smile, and he was a quick wit, and he always wanted to bring a smile to your face. That was my brother.
There's a publication ban on the case of Joseph's death, and it's still before the courts. It hasn't been determined that the death was drug-related. What I can tell you is that there's a manslaughter charge pending.
I got to the point where the deaths have to stop, regardless of what the exact cause was. It's all interrelated, that our people are dying. We've got to do something about this.
The community called on the chief and council to take a hard look at the issue. They met at the Makwa Center. That's a gathering place for many reasons. It usually holds fun things like bingo, sports, and cultural events. For this meeting about the opioid crisis, 150 people showed up. Remember, there's only 250 adults in the community, so that's a lot.
We heard the very personal stories. We heard people say, for example, my brother or my sister or myself, I've been through this life. And we sat and we listened to everybody. And everybody needed to vent. Everybody needed to tell their stories. And it was a long and very painful meeting that we had to really underline the need to do something.
Declaring a state of emergency does a few things. It lets outsiders in, so paramedics came in to support the community health team. The Ontario Provincial Police came into reserve to respond to overdose incidents and to investigate trafficking. Pickwackinac got more naloxone kits and gave them out to community members and businesses. These things help. Of course, remember what Tanya told us. Naloxone only works if the supply is clean. Still, Pickwackinac doesn't have the one thing they really need, a way to stop the addictions. The thing about every First Nation that makes it so different from a town or a city is that everybody is someone's cousin, unlike in the city, where the addicted are strangers. If you see somebody behaving strangely on the reserve, you know them. You know your neighbor's business. You are your brother's keeper. So addiction is not just about the pain of losing somebody you love. It's about desperately hoping to save someone you love or protect someone you love.
It's a lot of discussion back and forth right now on deciding how to move forward and approach it without, I guess, offending a lot of people as well. You have some people that are angry that the community's in this situation, and then you got others that kind of want to work through it in the best way where nobody's really harmed or nobody's getting pushed out or feeling like they're not part of the community because they're addicted.
Unlike the nearby towns, Pequawknagon has no hospital and no treatment facility. And with the rising opioid crisis seemingly everywhere, there's a lineup to get help.
We do have one individual in Pequawknagon that's been seeking a treatment facility for some time. And it's been like weeks and weeks of trying to get someplace and ended up having to get some counseling therapy from the center, but that would be remotely before they could actually even get a bed. And so the deck is stacked against us in that regard of finding a place for people to go, because when you look at it, the nature of the beast is that when a person is ready to go, sometimes you have a narrow window to get them outdoor and into a treatment facility. And if you miss that window and you miss that opportunity, well, that's the nature of addiction. The opportunity is there, you have to act upon it. If you don't act upon it, the opportunity is lost. It might be years, if ever, that person ever gets to that point again, or at some point it may result in tragedy at some point. So it's a big challenge.
There's only so much help, it seems, that can come in from the outside. So the community's recruiting volunteers on reserve and off and from other First Nations to pitch in alongside the health services team.
People came out to say, I'm here to help and I want to contribute. And when they came out to that meeting, and then that's when we started to organize them and say, okay, what we're going to do is that you will be the committee, you will be the task force, you will be the person that directs our response to the state of emergency. We've identified four specific pillars of response that we can organize our efforts into, the first pillar being prevention, the second one being a treatment, and the third being aftercare. And the fourth pillar really is around community safety. And community safety then deals with making sure that our elders feel safe within their community, making sure that the community is safe, and making sure that people who may be addicts are safe from the lifestyle.
Pequawknagon and other communities have had success before with cultural and spiritual programming. It doesn't cure addiction, but in the past, programs have helped with prevention and resiliency during recovery. Both Tanya and Kevin have joined the community's task force. Kevin's focused on prevention and aftercare. He's hopeful, but it's still early days.
How can we prevent something from happening? Well, the exposure to culture and being involved in cultural activities generally deters people from wanting to participate in drug use and alcohol use because the two don't work hand in hand. Generally, if you're doing cultural practices on the regular, you really don't have time to venture off and do the nonsense, right? I'm teaching these youth to sing. I'm teaching them the opportunities that come with the drum because I've been a singer for about 20 years, right? So that post-treatment is a lot of personal effort. And some people don't have that capability. So like what works for me and what I'm doing to move forward on my healing journey might not necessarily work for someone else, and they might not have that ability to do it on their own. Some people do rely heavily on that that buddy system for healing as well.
But fentanyl is different. It's just a harder drug to get off. As a reporter, I've watched more than 71 First Nations fall into a state of emergency due to opioids, and so far none have recovered. These states of emergency in some cases have been going on for 8 years. At least 2 First Nations are suing the federal government for emergency assistance funding. I almost never report on my own community. I have too many relations in Pequawknagon, too many cousins. It just gets conflict of interest-y. So why this time? I'll admit it. Because I'm pissed off. In the last few weeks, I watched a story about a similar crisis in Belleville, a small city just west of Kingston, blow up in the media. Belleville's state of emergency made headlines in the Toronto Star, the Globe. The National Post wrote, "Belleville is the new symbol of Canada's small-town opioid crisis." The new symbol of Canada's small-town opioid crisis? Is it? I told you off the top about a girl from my community in an Eganville Leader story. To me, the new symbol of Canada's small-town opioid crisis is a young kid who's carrying the burden of trying to win money to help solve the opioid crisis in her community. And that story should have been the lead, but it got buried 10 paragraphs down. That's your Canada Land. I want to remind you about Canada Labs, our new initiative to create a hub for young journalists. In particular, there's our Audio Journalism Fellowship Program. In partnership with Journalists for Human Rights, it offers 2 students a paid 4-month placement in Canada Land's newsroom and an opportunity to work alongside and learn from our team of seasoned journalists and editors. Applications close on March 13th, 2024. So make sure to check it out at canadaland.com/CanadaLabs. You can email me at karen@canadaland.com. That's K-A-R-Y-N because I spell it differently. Or you can email jesse@canadaland.com. He really does read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. This week's show was reported by me, Karen Pugliese, editor-in-chief. Tristan Capacchione is our audio editor and technical producer. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Our production coordinator is Andre Prue. Jesse Brown is back next week. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Allison Smith, publisher of Queen's Park Today, Alberta Today, British Columbia Today, Parliament Today, and you're here today. You're also, of course, the co-host with me of the Wag the Dog podcast. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, Jono.
Yay.
Thanks for having me.
So, today on the show, Rob Oliphant went out to play upon a tangled web of very strong feelings about the Middle East one day. And the Local Journalism Initiative, what is it? What was it? Is it, will it still be here? I don't know. Kind of a neat thing. And I think most people, even most journalists, don't quite understand. Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news.
Liberal MP and Parliamentary Secretary Rob Oliphant ripped into his government's policy on the war in Gaza.
That report details leaked audio from a call Oliphant had with a constituent.
It is opportunistic. It is unfair, and it is maligning the operation of a UN organization.
We have always had
a strong number of people who feel and who reflect the diversity of perspectives and views across the country.
Well, it's another example of how Justin Trudeau is a two-faced phony on the Middle East, just like everything else.
Oliphant's criticism of Israel was excoriating. Beyond even brutal military action, these were acts of extermination, the killing of no mere enemy, but of those who, in the killer's eyes, were less than human, whose very existence was to be viewed as a scourge. It was, in short, the urge to commit genocide at its most evil.
Wait, no, that's the Harper op-ed.
Yeah, that's actually Stephen Harper's op-ed titled Israel's Just War that appeared on the front page of Tuesday's National Post. We'll get back to that. The Oliphant situation is considerably more scrambled than the weird, stark clarity of Harper's. And I don't mean clarity as a positive, necessarily, or a positive, just like those were some very direct words. So just a little bit of background. So Rob Oliphant, because he may not be a name most people know, he is the Member of Parliament for Don Valley West, which is a riding in North York and Toronto. He's been there since 2008 when he succeeded John Godfrey. He was really awesome. He founded the King's Journalism School and actually died a couple months ago. He was cool. But Oliphant, for the past 5 years, has pretty much continuously been the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So, you know, his comments carry weight and is the sort of thing that, you know, a government might be alarmed about and is the sort of person where, especially on this issue, might be careful about being surreptitiously recorded, especially if you're going to present positions that are potentially contradictory.
Very contradictory.
There are a couple stories here. So let me actually lay out a timeline of what has, from what I've figured out, has happened with Rob Oliphant since the start of this year. In January 13th, he held a New Year's levy event with another MP. Some comments he made there that were recorded, those don't come out yet, so put that aside. On February 1st, he has a call with a constituent that's surreptitiously recorded. Now put that aside. On February 9th, he attends something called the One Love Gala at the Jamaican Canadian Association. Basically, he has what is described in some posts on X as remarks that were, I guess, characterized as being dismissive of Palestinian people in attendance. 4 days later, that same person who tweeted about that posts this recording of him at the New Year's levy, in which he alludes to a couple of his colleagues in Liberal caucus as being arrogant for presuming that Israel is, or believing that Israel is guilty of genocide prior to a ruling on that matter from the International Court of Justice.
I would never declare genocide unless I was in a court of law and I had all the evidence. So I disagreed completely with some of my colleagues who are so arrogant. I have lived in West Bank.
The next day, the call from February 1st is reported by the CBC. There was a call recorded by the constituent. This is a constituent who, in the CBC, just does not identify the constituent who has been calling for a ceasefire in the conflict because she fears publicity will lead to professional reprisals. So she shares with the CBC the audio of this call with Rob Oliphant, in which he's critical of his government's unclear messaging around the ICJ case, as well as the way his government pulled funding from UNRWA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, following allegations from Israel that some of UNRWA's staff participated in the October 7th attacks, allegations for which I believe Israel has yet to share the evidence that it says it has. Oliphant was recorded saying, quote, "You don't stop aid to Gaza because of 12 or 13 employees out of 13,000. It drives me crazy," end quote. He also said Israel was probably engaging in genocidal activity and bluntly criticized the war itself, quote, "But I also understand that Netanyahu is hurting Israel, not only killing Gazans, but hurting Israel. So for the love of Israel, tell him to stop." The article about that and some of the audio was published by the CBC that led to all the things we heard in the sort of clip pack off the top of the show where the Prime Minister has to respond and Pauly Avre weighs in. On February 16th, he then apologizes to his colleagues whom he had called arrogant, which is then reported on February 17th, last Saturday, in the Post, which at the same time that it reports his comments from the New Year's levy. So very exhausting to explain. I imagine it's more exhausting to live. I imagine it's exhausting to be him, but also I would hope it's exhausting in the specific time. What do you think, Allison? That's a lot.
Yeah, I read the CBC story reporting on the constituent call when it came out. I did not know about a bunch of that other background that you covered. I mean, I think it's rare to get a story like that comes from a source like this, that comes from a constituent recording a member of parliament.